All right, welcome to O8's Digital Lunchbox. Glad you could join us today. Today's session is on problem solving. We know times are stressful and we want to do what we can to help out. So we have our experts here on hand to answer some questions that were submitted. So let's get started. So the first one, you guys, Google is now offering an updated GMB profile or Google My Business profile. Should I pay for that?
That's a great question, Corey. So the new feature really is going to get you a little badge that says that you're essentially like certified. You've gone through the process of showing that you're a reputable business, and it will be appearing with a little green check mark, kind of like the verified badges that you'll see on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, things like that. The cost is $50 a month, and in lots of places, folks haven't started to really bite on this, at least around us in Minneapolis here. So if not a lot of your competitors are on board yet, you may want to wait it out. It is still kind of, Google's billing it as an experimental feature. So you may pay for something that might never really do anything for you and go away. But if you're also in a really competitive area, that $50 a month may make a difference for you. Unfortunately, I haven't seen any studies or anything like that out from Moz or Clickstream or anyone who does research on this kind of stuff yet, just because it is so new. Maybe Andy, Seth, if you guys have seen something in that stream.
The guy to follow on this is a gentleman by the name of Tom Waddington, and he's all over Twitter on this topic. And what he basically says is that, yes, this is brand new. It's only being rolled out in certain areas. There is divided opinion, as you can expect, amongst SEO people, some of whom, a lot of SEO experts, think this is a terrible idea. Essentially, it's a pay-to-play game that Google is playing with what have been up to this point a non-paid organic local listing. But there's others who say that it's potentially Google's way of combating spam in some of these listings, because a lot of people will game them by putting stuffing keywords into the titles of their business, or in some cases even doing DBAs or renaming their businesses in order to get to kind of be at the top of the local pack. It's a mixed bag. Nobody has any data yet that indicates that this is going to get you better click-through rates, or it's going to get you higher in rankings, but there's many who suspect that it will, either because Google will give you a little extra boost, or because of the credibility of the check mark will be a bit of social proof. Should also mention that to get the check mark, it's not just you have to apply and pay them the $50, but you are actually agreeing that your business is going to be verified. So they'll do background checks on your business and on all of your employees of your business. This is originally from their advanced local listings, where they, someone's kind of come into they'll go into a house and do repairs and so forth, and they want to absolutely verify that this is a completely legit business. So this is where this originally comes from. So they'll do thorough background checks. If you pass that, then you are eligible to pay them for the check mark, which is really actually the new thing about this. This is already an existing service, but they have modified it somewhat to make it more of a subscription.
Yeah, I'll be really interested to see as this rolls out to more locations, what the impact is going to be on the ranking within those local packs, Andy. This might be a great shortcut for folks who don't necessarily have the time or the willingness to be posting regularly to their Google My Business profile. But if you don't want to pay the $50 right now and you're already creating social content, a great way to help your listings within the local packs and to help boost some of the metrics that Google looks at within your GMB account is going to be to post to it regularly, just like you would your Facebook or your Instagram accounts. So that's an alternative to paying the $50. You might see some gain there in the local packs.
Right. So if you're inclined and have the money just lying around and would like to see if this improved your rankings, by all means, it might be worth it as an experiment, but right now a lot of folks are in wait and see mode.
Yeah, if you do it, reach out to us. We'd love to see we'd love to see the results that you get from it.
Definitely. You guys ready for the next one?
You bet.
All right, next one is e-commerce question. I am a small business owner who needs to transition to an e-commerce model. What CMS should I use that is feasible for a smaller budget?
You're not alone. There's a lot of folks who are seeing this this pressure to shift. And this is a pretty common question, I think. There are a lot of different options out there. If you have a WordPress site, WooCommerce might be a great option. That's a good plugin. If you're on Square, using Square for your payment terminals, they have a really kind of rough and tumble, very, very basic online e-commerce option that you could use for a storefront. But a really great entry point if your website is old, outdated, or really just needs a refresh and you don't have a lot of budget, Squarespace is something that we like to direct clients to. Their e-commerce offering is really great, and it will also hook into some other applications and things like that to help amplify your reach of your e-commerce store.
I'd also add that Squarespace has got, if you're just trying to figure this all out and you're looking to be for a guided process, you don't have a million hours to spend kind of redesigning and thinking about your site. They have wizards that if you're a small business, you could just literally walk through and say, what kind of business do I have? What am I selling, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the end of that process, it will show you several example stores and give you template choices. So it's very much holds your hand through the processes, and the templates that they're offering are really good, very clean and nicely designed. So it's a quick shortcut to getting a store up and running at a fairly low cost.
Yeah, and I would just add that, of course, think about how you're going to get people to your online store, right? Are people going to come via search, or do you have an existing digital presence where it's easy to redirect people to an e-commerce store? Of course, think about those things before choosing a platform.
Sounds good. So in relation to small businesses here, the next question is actually, you know, let's say I'm a small business and I need a website. Should I build one myself on a platform like Squarespace, or should I hire an agency partner? What advice do we want to give to small businesses?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. Of course, it comes down to your budget and your long-term goals. And again, thinking about, okay, I've got a website now, how am I gonna get people there and engaging with it? And once they're there, will they engage with it? Squarespace is a really great DIY platform, but there are certain gotchas like search engine optimization and messaging. You know, once people get there, do they know clearly what you do and what the next step is to take action? Some of these things that it's easy to miss. So those factors, and also you can consult with an agency, you know, someone like us, maybe to get you started, right? You want to do the work, fine. We can help you with some ideas, some consultation, set you up with a keyword strategy, things like that.
Yeah, that strategy piece is really where an agency partner is going to help when you're thinking about a platform like Squarespace. Squarespace will reduce a lot of the technical debt and really just allow you to do fairly easily a lot of the content addition and things that will drive up, you know, the costs of a website redesign or creating a new site when you're looking at working with an agency partner. But really where it can't fill the gap is the strategy, the keyword research, the on-page optimization from an SEO perspective. Squarespace does a great job from a technical perspective with the SEO pieces, but you know, it can't tell you, okay, if this particular product, what keyword should you trying to be write this product listing and detail page for? Is it optimized, well optimized for that keyword? how are you getting this out to the masses? Because e-commerce isn't something where build it and they'll come. You have to put it in front of people. And so those are the things where the agency is going to really help. And then taking that platform and that website that you've just created and really diving into some of the add-ons that you can jump into for a relatively low cost, like the email marketing platform and the ad platform integrations that Squarespace offers, to really help you then boost the ROI of your internal investment and the small investment that you would have with an external agency partner.
A lot of this is really going to come down to your mindset too as a small business owner. There are small business owners who are just fascinated with this stuff and building the website and would be all in on getting their hands dirty and really figuring out how to get the most out of the digital marketing and website building tools that an organization like Squarespace or Wix or any of the others offer. Often we often refer to Squarespace because we do think it's a good site builder. But then there are others, small business owners, who just could care less. They just need a website quickly. They want to go back to running their business. And you could go down a lot of rabbit holes in the process of trying to stand something up. The sites don't necessarily fix everything. Although they're certainly not fixing my siding right now is probably. I'll go back on mute.
Okay. So if you build it, no one will probably come. You need to have a strategy in place. That's where an agency can help you out. Makes sense, guys. So the next question is in relation to search. This is a good one. It seems like no matter what I do, I can't pass my competitor in Google search rankings. What are they doing that I'm not?
So this is a question where having the right tool set and experience to leverage that tool set is going to come into play. You heard us talk earlier about your keyword strategy and keyword research. This will look something like, to answer this question, it would look something like digging into your competitor's site, doing an audit of their keywords using some tools that we have in our tool belts as SEOs to deconstruct those pages, to take a look at Google and Bing and see where they're ranking well for those, and then identify gaps between your site and theirs. Oftentimes, your site probably will be outranking some of their pages on certain areas, whereas others, they're going to be outranking yours. And so using those gap analysis tools in the SEO's tool belt is really going to be important. And then also taking a look at what digital advertising your competitor is doing. More often than not, Google is taking into account page traffic into its rankings. And one thing that you can do to boost your organic SEO rankings is to build traffic to your page. Well, the question becomes, if I don't have traffic to my page, but Google wants me to have a high traffic page, well, how am I ever going to get to the top, right? And the way to do that is through paid advertising. This model kind of creates a pay-to-play type scenario in certain instances. And this is one where you may benefit in organic rankings by actually running digital ads. I know that sounds confusing and maybe even a little counterintuitive, but it's the reality that we live in that Google's created for us here. And another big piece is going to be that Google My Business profile that we talked about earlier. Google is increasingly funneling more and more metrics for your other pages in your site's organic rankings, tying those back to the activity and the things that are happening in that Google My Business profile. So that all comes into play here, especially if you're looking at any localized keywords or really some regional specific keyword rankings here.
Right. We should mention some of the tools, a couple that you can get for either free or low cost. Uber Suggest is really good. This is Neil Patel's tool. There's a paid component to it, but you can go quite a ways with the non-paid version to do competitive research, and it will show you what your competitor is ranking for, what you could be ranking for. He even has some great videos as to how to review your competitor sites and potentially see where you have overlapping keywords and use that information to rank better. You can also use paid tools like Moz or SEMrush that will tell you, give you competitive information and also give you a sense of how your domain overall ranks according, you know, based in comparison to a competitor's, because that's super important. If your domain doesn't have the authority of your competitors, then chances are, just as a general rule, they're always going to rank higher than you. So in order to increase that authority, you need to be potentially expanding your site, producing more content, creating more ultra useful and relevant information on your site, so that those, and getting backlinks, all of those things which help you in your authority.
Yeah, ultimately, you know, there's of course so many factors that go into SEO, but if you're not writing truly, because you're competing with the internet here, right? So if you're not writing truly meaningful, valuable content, you know, we see so often folks just churning out documents with a, maybe even with a keyword strategy, but it's not really good content. Maybe it's not structured well, technically, things like that. So this is way too long of an answer for this episode, but just think at a high level, okay, am I creating content that is better than my competitors? Like, that's a really simple yet complex thing to think about.
All right, so since we're on the topic of, you know, digital marketing still, I was going to jump to the offline conversions question. Is there a way to tie offline conversions back to a specific campaign?
Another great question. Andy, do you want to, I'm going to pull up this, let's see, we've got a closed loop marketing diagram here. Can you all see this? Super. Mm-hmm. Andy, do you want to talk us through how we approach closed loop marketing with our clients?
Yeah, sure. Sorry, I'm muted and you may hear banging next to me. So if it gets to be insane, I'll just toss it back to one of the other. Okay. I apologize. But essentially, so you have the issue of if you've got an online store, as we were talking about before, and all of your conversions are happening online and they're all e-commerce transactions, then it's fairly straightforward to set up e-commerce or enhanced e-commerce tracking in Google Analytics. And to be able to see which products, which keywords, which campaigns, which emails, et cetera, are resulting in purchases. And you know, and then you can look at all of that and evaluate it in a pretty objective way. But what happens if you have a long sales cycle or you have a sales team and your conversions happen offline? They happen as a result of relationships, so they may happen on a phone call or after a very long exchange of emails. More often than not, you'll have a sales system like Salesforce, you'll have a CRM or a back-end marketing back-end like HubSpot that enables you to track all of that information as you're going through. As somebody goes from being in an initial contact to a qualified lead to ultimately to a sales lead and an opportunity and finally converted. So what this requires is for you to close the loop. Since the conversion's happening offline, you need to know that it happened. And so the way that we do this is by first on the first part of the cycle, and you can sort of follow it around clockwise from top to bottom on this diagram. When you're first converting, you know, in the initial conversion happens, whether you're typically filling out some sort of lead form or making some kind of inquiry, then that information is captured in Google Analytics. It's often associated with a goal for a form fill. And then in the background, what's important is to capture the Google client ID or user ID, and then also any associated IDs, such as, say, a Google Ads ID or Facebook ID. There are called GCL ID or FBCL IDs. that get associated with those records. So you put all of those records, you put that all together and pass that along to HubSpot or to whatever your CRM is, so that those records are now associated, those ID numbers are actually associated with the contact information. And that's held outside of Google Analytics, so there's no conflict as far as privacy goes. Your client or your prospect is known in HubSpot, and then this information just rides along in the record. Well, now, several months down the road, we're now kind of at about 7 o'clock in the diagram, the sale closes offline, and now you're going to trigger a conversion event when that happens in HubSpot that is essentially going to send that information from the record back. It's going to signal Google Analytics that, hey, offline conversion happened. Please record this as an event. And by the way, please associate it with these IDs and pass these back to Google Analytics and and for that matter, to AdWords or the Facebook Pixel, so that you have a complete record and you can then go back and you can do attribution. Down the road, when you want to look at, I made this sale and where did it come from, you can trace that all the way back through HubSpot and ultimately back into Google Analytics to say, ah, it was this version of this creative on this campaign during this period that actually resulted in that sale. In fact, it looked like I got about a 20% lift in sales based on this one campaign relative to the other. So now you're closing the loop. That is essentially how closed loop marketing works. Super important to really be able to follow that all that value chain all the way through to the end if you are doing offline sales.
That, and it's important to note that the model that Andy just discussed, that's most relevant in B2B scenarios. B2C and e-commerce scenarios, there are going to be additional steps, including, you know, and that's where things like loyalty programs and stuff where you can tie back purchases to an individual account through an email or something like that, that, you know, physical purchases that are happening in your store, that's going to be really important to then be able to tie back. You have something to tie back to your CRM and to your e-commerce platform, any of that in-store purchasing data back to the accounts and advertising and things online that user may have encountered along their user journey to that in-store purchase.
That's great. So the CRM integration is key to that process, Andy. And Tyler, I mean, it's assumed that most modern CRMs you can integrate with an open source like CMS. So we're talking like HubSpot or Salesforce, or I mean, they all can work that way.
Yeah, it can. It's not always as plug and play as you would like, particularly if your embedding forms and iframes are used. I'll let others talk more about the technicalities of that.
I've made this work also even with things not as fancy as HubSpot or Salesforce, mm-hmm. With tools as simple as MailChimp and Google Analytics, integrating with something like Square, where, you know, you're going to be able to tie back that loyalty program in the e-commerce setting becomes key with those offline sales, being able to then tie that back into your MailChimp account and, you know, use Google Analytics to tie that all back together. So you don't have to have super fancy tools, but there are a few key pieces along the way that you need in order to make that work.
Sounds good. Cool. I think we have, you know, we only got 5 minutes left. Should we try to sneak in one more question here, guys?
Yeah.
Let's see here. Maybe we end on the, and I know this topic can get vast, but on, this is for our Drupal friends with the Drupal 7 end of life coming. So Drupal 7 end of life is coming after Drupal 8's end of life, but I also shouldn't upgrade to Drupal 9 yet. Help, this is so confusing. What should I do?
Yep. Oh, COVID.
Right.
So on our website, we've got a handy dandy chart here that kind of outlines this for us. You'll see that just as Corey, you've described Drupal 8 end of life here, reaches end of life in Q4 of 2021, with Drupal 7 confusingly reaching end of life in 2022. The reason for this is, you know, moving from Drupal 8 to Drupal 9 is going to be much quicker and much cheaper than it has been upgrading major Drupal versions in the past. This is going to be more in line with updates that you might see in like WordPress, for instance. And so that move, if you're on Drupal 8 to Drupal 9, you don't need years. You need days, maybe weeks, depending on how complex your site is, to get that updated and tested. Whereas if you're on Drupal 7 with COVID, that has thrown in all kinds of complications around availability of workforce as well as monetary constrictions that really have sucked up all the funds that a lot of organizations are planning to use for their Drupal 7 migration. Because that can take a year plus, depending on, you know, the size of your site, you need more time to get off Drupal 7 and get up to Drupal 8 or 9 than you would to get from Drupal 8 to Drupal 9. And so that extended life there is really going to be important for organizations who have been hit hard by COVID, who have a large Drupal 7 site and are going to need to get off before they need to start paying for long-term support on Drupal 7.
Excellent. Chart is very helpful to visualize what's going on here. Well, I think that we're at time, everybody. I'd like to thank our expert panelists for joining us today. And, you know, follow O8 on LinkedIn, follow us on Facebook to get the latest on the next digital lunchbox coming to you soon. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Corey.
Yep.
Thanks, everyone.
See ya.